not, the consequence most likely will be war.
And Trudy Parsi, we just have 10 seconds, but you're in Sweden right now. I'm wondering people's view in Sweden of the United States and President Trump that you've been speaking to.
I've never before seen the people here in Sweden be as concerned about what's happening in the United States that I see them today. People are glued to democracy now, New York Times, Washington Post, and they are just genuinely worried about the future of the United States and the consequences it will have for the entire globe.
Trudy Parsi, I want to thank you for being with us, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. We'll link to your piece, Mask is Off, Trump is Seeking War with Iran, author of the new book, Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday to Jamaya Lewis. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is always looking for ways people can work with us and support us. KBOO has a wish list, and we'd love help getting some of those items donated. Some things on our list include a color printer, digital recorders, a pop-up canopy, dishwashing detergent, brooms and mops, or services like roofing, plumbing, and electrical work. Please contact station co-manager Delphine at del@kboo.org or go to kboo.fm/kboo's wishlist. For more information about supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Business of Diversity on August 7th at 11 a.m. at the Sentinel Hotel in Portland. The Business of Diversity will be a conversation about the impact of diversity on the economy and business in Oregon. This panel discussion features business owners, educators, and community leaders. Again, that's the Business of Diversity on August 7th at 11 a.m. at the Sentinel Hotel, 614 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. That's 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany. Certainly we are aware of changes that are happening in our country and how we approach several aspects of our lives together. This morning, here on your radio station, More Talk Radio, we will talk about public lands, what's happening, how we are transforming our public lands, or how our public lands are being transformed right as we speak. We're aware of the actions of far-right militants, such as what happened at the occupation of Malheur National Wildlife Reserve last year. Our public lands are under threat in ways we have not seen before. Celeste and I, Cecil, will speak with Kristen Tagan to discuss her upcoming course, which will be offered through Portland Underground Graduate School, or as it's known by its acronym PUGS, about the course which will examine the history of our public lands and what what things are happening right now. Kristen is a scholar and anti-oppression activist. She also teaches at Portland State University, where she teaches the history of communities of color in Oregon and issues related to the liberation of women and women's homelessness. I want to remind you to be a part of our conversation this morning, and you may give us a call at 503-231-8187.
Did you think about how this is really not new? I mean, if you look back, and I'm sure Kristen will agree with us, that you saw the theft of public lands not only in Europe, but there's always been a challenge for lands. And sometimes it was a corporation grasp, such as the expansion by the railroads. And sometimes it was the theft by individual people.
That certainly is the case. So we'll expand this conversation.
Okay. Okay.
Want to introduce our guest?
No, you were doing fine. I couldn't help but interrupt that little piece right there because I was thinking of Robert Barron's. You know, ADD, it just jumped right to my tongue.
Well, good morning, Kristen.
Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So first, tell us how you got interested in teaching about land and communities and how you found the environment here in Portland receptive, because this is a hot button item here in this state.
Right.
Has been.
Yes, I agree. You are absolutely right that these kinds of conflicts around public land have traced back to the beginning of our country, if not earlier than that. Going through a master's degree in history, I was fascinated to the extent to which these conflicts around public land have never been quieted. They've always been in our nation's history, and they address sort of this critical conflict between state power, local power, and federal power. And so while the latest case with the Bundy brothers out in Malheur was one significant instance that we all sort of point to, there were Bundy brothers all throughout the West, all throughout our nation's history. So absolutely, it's something that has just been around forever in our country.
And given human nature and the business attitude toward expansion, it's not to be unexpected. It's not unusual. It's kind of that case of capitalism, or really any business venture would seek some way of expansion. So it's not something that's unknown to human nature to want to do this. I think that's one thing we need to think about. It's competing interests, just basically that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the states in the West are in a unique position compared to the ones in the East. The government in the early days of the United States grabbed Native American lands, but then transferred them almost immediately to private interests. And whereas in the West, they did similar types of things, but there were simply huge swaths of land that people found were not arable, were not appropriate for. They needed more than the government was giving away to graze their cattle. But it doesn't mean in Oregon that, you know, the land grabs weren't horrific. In fact, the genocide against Native American people in Oregon, you know, 9 out of 10 Native American people were killed between 1840 and the beginning of the next century, specifically because white people wanted that land. Despite that, about 53% of the land was not something that private interests wanted to specifically own, so that portion of our land is public land. But you're absolutely right about the capitalist interests, because the vast majority of our public land is now available under permitting processes for logging, for grazing, for mining extraction. So it's not as though it's protected and locked away forever to be protected in terms of the law right now. Only 4% of Oregon's wilderness is protected not to be used. You have to protect it for in perpetuity, at least until the Secretary of Interior gets hold of it.
So I don't want to lose fact of a figure that you just shared with us briefly in terms of the genocide of the native population. Share something more about the land grab and the impact on native populations.
Yeah, so when the gold rush started in the West, it brought huge numbers of white people to the state of Oregon. As I'm sure you know, African Americans were legally forbade from living here in Oregon. It brought a huge influx of white people. They did a couple of things. First is they destroyed the native way of, some native tribes' way of using agriculture. They would use terraced forms of agriculture along the rivers. And the Native American, or the Gold Rush people, they ended up wiping away those terraced forms of agriculture to be able to use placer mines. They, in 1850, a very Oregon-specific law called the Oregon Donation Land Act was passed, in which it guaranteed every white person, white couple, 320 acres for free. Talk about bootstraps in American society. 320 acres of land was given away for free, and it was taken from Native Americans. And to secure, you know, if someone comes into your house right now and claims it is your own, you're going to fight back. And so that's exactly what the Native Americans did. But in 1854, the territorial legislature passed a law that said no arms or ammunition could be sold to Native Americans. So they were dramatically overpowered by the U.S. military that came in with guns. So between starvation and the wars, and then diseases, you know, diseases were brought into the state that they were, Native Americans were immune to. Those three factors combined to basically kill 9 out of 10 Native Americans in an extraordinarily and shockingly short period of time, 60 years.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the metropolitan area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, in the Willamette River Valley, it's 104.3, and in the world, it's KBOO.FM. And we're speaking to our current administration's attitude toward what should be protected public land and how we are losing it, and possibly even ways we might try to still fight to protect it, mm-hmm. but share it amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's the point that the land here in Oregon, as much of the land in this country, on this continent, has been, was wrested away violently from the native population, and mm-hmm. then shared. And before we get too much more into that, I just want to mm-hmm. get a little bit more of a closer look at how you had the opportunity. What qualified a white couple for being able to get land? Because as we know, there's the perception that just because you were white, you got stuff, but all white wasn't equal.
Well, it basically meant that you were willing to come out to Oregon and you were willing to cultivate the land for 5 years, and that you would stay on the land for 5 years. You would turn it into something. You know, we had a very sort of different way of agriculture than the Native Americans did. So if you cultivated it and you stayed on it for 5 years, then it was yours.
So basic homestead type act.
Exactly, mm-hmm. yeah. The Homestead Act came later, this was just 10 years later, though. Mm-hmm. This was a very Oregon-specific act.
And so you had a lot of people come in and form communities, and given the fact that we have a lot of small towns in here, I get the impression that it would be kind of insular groups that weren't necessarily well connected.
You're absolutely right. Yes. They were insular groups, and, you know, at the turn of the century, the, you know, the United States government was starting to notice that our forests were being eroded and the land was being taken advantage of, and so Theodore Roosevelt started the process. He was set the precedent of the government maintaining control over federal lands with national parks and all of that. We have one. We have the Crater Lake National Park. And then the federal government started to get more and more involved after the Dust Bowl. But in terms of soil management techniques and things like that. But at the same time, the federal government was very happily letting the settlers use the land in the way that they wanted, that they saw fit. So they did form, you're exactly right, they did form these insular communities where their entire way of life was built around logging or grazing. And so it's quite a shock when the federal government later on, decades later, tells you that you can't log, you can't graze the same way that you have been for years.
Those who are listening we're just getting a taste, a bit of knowledge of what you're sharing. I want you just to share a little bit about the course that you're offering and how people might participate.
Well, it's on the Portland Underground Graduate School website, which is being taught every Monday night from 6 to 8:30. It's $125 for all 4 weeks, every Monday in August. And we would love to welcome you to the class. We're going to be talking about some of the things that we've just been talking about, as well as some ways in which we can work to protect the lands that we have now. While we don't have much set aside as wilderness in Oregon, what we do have is being threatened. The federal government has in the past terminated the land rights of Native Americans in our state. They lost 857,000 acres of land in the 1850s, and there is no telling about whether the Trump administration will terminate Native land claims in our state again. So right now, you know, not only do Native lands face a threat, wilderness lands face a threat, and then in terms of public lands, you know, that are open to logging and grazing, there can be and there has, you know, started to be a huge threat to the viability of those lands.
We welcome your calls to speak with Kristen regarding her program, rather her class, or a little bit more about PUGS, or especially about this class. You know, land is political, and I stole that from you.
Right.
Yeah, I'm gonna give my qualifier real quick.
Well, I don't know if I use that. I'm using it now, though. That's good.
Okay. You know, the reason I was saying that is that here in Portland, in Oregon, on a wider basis, everything is political. And so, you know, there's a really good reason to think in terms of protecting public lands. And it's not just that one that pops into mind, which is everybody needs a green space to be healthy and recreate, or farmers need to be able to have access to lands for water rights or what have you. It's that whole idea of maintaining the land for the common good and the common power. So folks, join us in the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187.
Now, for those who will take your course, you certainly will give a history of land and its importance to the various population and the movement of migration of people. And it seems, you know, for someone who just have a very slight knowledge of the history of this state, there seems to have been often a conflict over land and ownership and who has the right to do what with what piece of land, right? And certainly, recently, in recent decades, mm-hmm. it seems as if there has been a battle somewhat in defining land and land rights. And certainly, it seems to, whether one's of the political left or the political right, it seems to influence one's perception of the land. I assume that in your course, you'll discuss this about land and land rights and the battle between so-called private land and public land and how those things are used. What are some of the important points you would touch upon about land and land rights in this course?
Well, I think particularly in Oregon, land has been the foundation upon which almost all of our wealth has been built, whether it's been timberland or the fact that agriculture comprises the biggest portion of our biggest, you know, it's at the top of our economy here in Oregon, or whether it's the grazing lands out in eastern Oregon. That's how people in Oregon became wealthy over, you know, until the tech hit. That's how you got rich. And so you're right that these conflicts have dated back. It wasn't, like you mentioned, it wasn't just the Bundy brothers. And I think that there is an inherent conflict in some of those struggles. And it is often pitched as a battle of left and right, where those on the right are wanting more and more and more access to cut down the trees, to graze the cattle along stream beds that are fragile, those types of conflicts, versus what those folks see, those folks who are waking up at 5 o'clock every morning to go into the forests regardless of the weather, those folks see way over in Washington, D.C., you know, what had been, in terms of the Obama administration and the Clinton administration, restrictions on their right to do that. So they see, in, you know, not only in Washington, D.C., but the Forest Service in Portland, Oregon, some latte-drinking bureaucrat trying to limit their rights to the life that they have built for themselves. So it's being pitched as left and right, but, you know, there is a part of that where myself as a completely left-wing person can see why there's frustration, can see why there's anger on the part of people who feel like their livelihoods, their right to make a living, are being stripped away. Now, I also see that the federal government has had very little choice. They have to protect the land. They have to protect the streams, or there won't be anything left for anybody to enjoy, regardless of there's forests there to cut down in perpetuity, or there are salmon running up the streams, things like that. They have to do what they're doing, or did, up until January 2017.
Because we live in a part of this country where environmental concerns are so important, and you mentioned in terms of land, in terms of the challenge and difference in flex philosophies around grazing and timber and how to use the property. We've become very wise in the language we use. So someone who is interested in the land and hears something like the term wise use movement, what is that? That sounds something
It good. Sounds like it would be good, just like a right to work.
Yes. You know, you pegged it. I don't have to say anything more. That's it. It's one of those oxymorons, you know, clean coal, military intelligence. Like, it's not. Wise use basically just meant trying to figure out a way to still get access to the land, but pitch it in a way that sounds sustainable. That sounds like, you know, if we just apply some scientific method here, it'll all be okay. But it wasn't, that movement was not that. It was basically a way to continue to get as much access as they possibly could. So,
So how do we approach the conflicting interests? A couple of decades on, when the economy began to change, and before
the microchip industry started surpassing the timber industry, and we were not being flexible in our vision about mm-hmm. how to sustain economies without draining or fighting over the land.
Mm-hmm. So, how do we build a different future?
A different future, yeah.
Well, I'm sure y'all know about OPAL, OPAL Environmental Justice. Yes. They are starting a statewide program, setting roots of a statewide program called Just Transitions, which is a move away from an extractive economy, they put it. That it's not just resources that are being extracted; labor is being extracted without much, without much of a vision for making that labor, sustainable. It kind of burns people out and throws them away. So they're working on working to restructure, sort of create conversations around restructuring our entire economy, moving away from extraction of labor, of resources, of goods. To something that is far more viable in terms of recognizing people's self-worth, in terms of limiting growth, limiting the sustainability of the community based entirely on the resources. We have this way of growing as a society as if the resources will always be there and there will always be enough resources there. But there has to be some vision to say, well, the water in that stream over there means that we'll only get a community of 50 people here. That's what the stream says.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Look.
I was going to ask, how do we create such conversations where all communities are involved? You hinted earlier in terms of latte drinking people in Portland as opposed to those who live on the land for generations and those communities. Yeah. There seems to be a inherent divide. Does that have to be?
Yeah. Is it an artificial divide and we're just not looking at our commonalities?
I think it is. I mean, it definitely has been a divide. There have been solutions, though. So there was something not nearly as destructive and violent as the Bundy brothers, but there was a movement in the 1990s called the County Supremacy Movement that sought to make the counties the prime land use decision makers in the state. And they passed a couple of ballot measures around the state and weren't ultimately successful in that goal. we have this supremacy clause thing in our Constitution. But what they were successful in achieving was the idea that the Forest Service would start listening to them more. So what ended up happening were coalitions, groups of the county supremacy activists, the county officials, environmentalists, federal, Forest Service or BLM officials, and they all sat down at the table and they crafted memorandums of understanding about what would go forward in terms of that latest Forest Service sale or that grazing permit or things like that. They all came up with an understanding of what they all wanted to have happen. And it was frustrating. Some of the activists were like, we spent 2 meetings deciding what we were called. So it wasn't like it was the easiest process. I'm sure we've all been in meetings like that. But they stuck with it, and it really made a significant difference in terms of the anger that people were feeling and also the feeling that environmentalists had that no matter what, the federal government was just going to sell, permits left and right. So I think that can be a model for how we can come together.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. And we encourage your phone calls to the show. I know that you've probably heard what you think is the last word in land management, land access. But trust me, with this new presidential administration. Things could change at a heartbeat. 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Kristen Tagan, who is the instructor for the course, who also teaches at Portland State University and has done her own share of research on land issues, community issues, and homelessness issues. So join in the conversation again, 503-231-8187. Well, we're trying to ask questions without giving away too much of the class, you know, because we want to we want to encourage people to take the course and be involved. And so let me shift gears just a little bit while we are talking about land, and we get back to that. I wanted to address the whole Portland Underground grad school concept, how you fit in and how you look at the opportunity to share knowledge with us at on a more accessible level.
I think it's a great model. I think it's wonderful that, you know, personally, when I left college, I was, there was definitely a point of sadness, like, okay, is that where knowledge ends? The idea of sitting around in a group of people who to discuss through ideas and discuss concepts and all of that seemed to be, for me, very sad, the notion that that only exists when you pay a high tuition and you sit in an ivory-covered building. You know, the idea that knowledge should be something that is exclusive to the 18 to 22-year-old set just seems a little bit, that it shouldn't be that way. So I love the concept of PUGS, the idea that you can take a class in such a wide variety of subjects and continue learning, continue talking to your peers, continue sharing your own knowledge in a classroom or in any sort of setting like that. So I think it's a great idea. It's sad to think that, as you know, as soon as you get that piece of paper, then you're no longer going to be in that type of environment. So I'm thrilled that it's been created.
One of the things I think is really wonderful about the classes, having been involved in some of PSU's, I don't know what they call it, extra curricular or how to exactly phrase it, but it's the wide variety of people that you get to connect with.
You
also get to enhance whatever skills you choose to, you know, to polish to go back out and serve your community.
Yes, I agree. There's all sorts of, you know, not just here, let's learn the history of this or the concept around that. You get to learn all sorts of things that are going to make you stronger as, you know, as workers, as citizens. So I think it's wonderful. I think I'm always on my soapbox too, personally, of teaching particularly fellow white people, white people like me, about the history of what white people have done in this state, the legacy of white supremacy in this state. We need to take responsibility for that as white people and change it. And so the idea that 25 people are going to sit in my class at PUGS and learn the history of white supremacy, or learn in this class the extent to which lands were taken from people, for me feels like a significant, you know, step in terms of making sure that we white people take responsibility for creating a different future in our state.
And strengthening community in a broader sense. And if I may, I'm gonna make a presumption here that it's not about shaming, it's not about allowing people to get caught up and focus more on themselves and their discomfort, but about how to visualize alternatives that have been present all along but generally have been ignored.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I mean, shame is helpful to the extent to which it motivates people to move, but that's not, you're right, it's not what it's about. That's not what I'm focusing on creating. We do need to grasp onto knowledge to create a different future for ourselves, though, in the rest of our state, whether it's in terms of issues of white supremacy or in terms of public land or any number of the other topics that PUGS explores. So I'm thrilled that it's there. I'm thrilled.
Now, is this your first class?
So. No, I taught another class. I taught another class in the winter about, like I said, white supremacy in Oregon. So, and I'll teach another one in the fall about white supremacy in Oregon.
And how well received was that, and how diverse was your class?
You know, there was one person of color out of 25 people. And in a way that made my heart sing, because it means that the white people in my course were stepping up to take responsibility. That they were acknowledging that they play a role, that we white people play a role right now in the way in which issues of white supremacy and racism play out in our community, on the streets that we walk on, and the, you know, schools that our kids go to. We need to now take responsibility so that we don't continue to be what we have been, a state where white supremacy has been able to take significant root.
I think one of the important things that, I hear from you is to address the some of the questions that people have about why are things the way they are. It, it isn't as if we just woke up one day and we're in this society, but there's a history that we need to learn about, and that's so important to uncover it. And a lot of it's not uncovering; it's just, you know, recognizing what is, and then we can begin to make changes based on where we were, we as a society were, and how we got here, and envision together what we want to become.
Exactly. Exactly. I couldn't have said it better. Yes.
And I'm really thrilled that the there's a group of instructors, and I don't really want to call you all teachers, but for want of a better word right now, I'm going to say teachers and facilitators. Well, because
facilitators. That's a good word. That's a good word.
Well, nothing's wrong with teachers. It's just that you know, we're trying to create a jointly envisioned future, you know, and and a jointly connected mindset for change. And I'm often wondering, see, when I moved to Portland and began my career as an Oregonian, one of the things that fascinated me was, why was there no real push with the change in the economy and the loss of logging for lots of reasons? Why was there no push for alternative education and to help people recognize that, yes, you have a right to a lifestyle, but not to one that will extract the absolute last iota of viability out of your environment, you know, that we have a right to and a duty to preserve it and to make it sustainable. And so I was always fascinated that people were fighting so hard to remain loggers when there were a lot of other viable skills. And you know, and I was wondering how much you feel that was kind of an artificial dichotomy that was posed, rather than the collective community coming together and saying, okay, wait a minute, stop. Let's see what we can come up with, because there are other there's other careers and fields we can go in where we can do something. I mean, and I was fascinated why there wasn't that level of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, there were snippets here and there. There were some retooling funds that the federal government gave out. There were, you know, some attempts. But in terms of the broad, large-scale replacement of a profession, there wasn't. You know, I don't know if we've ever done that well in terms of the United States, where the steel industry dies. There's nothing to replace it. Now the coal industry is dying. There's not much to replace it. So we do tend to, you know, in terms of a class issue, look at laborers, look at people who are going down into steel mines and working in or in coal mines and working in forests and all weather and all of that. And just sort of, like I was saying, sort of labor is an extractive process where we take, where our society takes without looking at the long-term viability of communities and what that means.
But so. I'm wondering if it's more than taking courses to learn a different different occupation, because we're talking about a people, a culture, a way of living and viewing life. So we can certainly well understanding if the government out in Washington D.C. comes, or mm-hmm. Salem comes and try to tell us how to reshape our right. society without our input, it becomes a difficult task.
Well, and that's what I'm mostly getting at. Not so much that they didn't provide resources, and thinking that it sounds like it was intentionally divisive because we did not, as a federal government, we did not walk to our states and say, let's brainstorm on how to make this work. I didn't see that collaborative effort. I didn't hear enough members of the community saying something to the effect of, look, we want somebody in here to help us retool this. You know, and that's what I thought was interesting in terms of community development. What was the dynamic? What had happened to keep that desire for conversation to, you know, from happening?
Yeah, but you're absolutely right that it didn't happen to the extent to which people wanted it. I think that I can only speculate in terms of why, you know, what was going on inside of people's heads about why they didn't want to move forward with a different type of a future and have some self-determination over that and a collective decision in terms of the community. But I do know that people had built their lives. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a job. They built their cultures around it. They built their identities around the idea that they were independent cattle ranchers. They were loggers. They were people who lived off the land, and people who live in cities just don't understand that reality. So I do feel like it's one thing about looking in the paper and trying to figure out a different job. It's another thing about changing your entire culture, changing your self-identity. It's not, I'm sure, an easy process.
And so it could be something as simple as that. If not the birthplace, we're one of the birthplaces of fables like Paul Bunyan, and our grandparents came from this place where we were one with the trees. And I'm not making light of that at all.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm just trying to wrap my head around it, because the gist of my question is that, and like you, I've studied a lot about community, is how communities sustain themselves, how they talk amongst themselves to survive, how they reimagine themselves when there's been some type of change, upheaval, catastrophe, or whatever, so mm-hmm. that they can survive. And I just look at the culture of the us versus them, you know, like the cattle ranchers versus the sheep ranchers versus the timber folks versus the railroad people versus the miners, and you know, and it seems like it's somebody's interest to keep all of those groups segregated, you know, instead
and
of
fighting
built
with
up.
Each other.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I'm trying to dig a little deeper, I guess. Maybe I'll end up having to take the class.
You're very, very welcome.
to try to understand, you know, the political aspect of land as politics. As well as identity.
Well, I think you're right in terms of land being politics as well. It's politics, it's economics, it's culture. It is woven through everything that we have used to define ourselves in the United States, and particularly, I would say in Oregon. We define ourselves in Oregon as being outdoors people, as people who mm-hmm. love the outdoors, as people who love to get out in the streams and to get in the forests and all of that. We define ourselves as people who have a history of protecting it through the bottle bill or the public beach laws, through our land use laws that prevent urban sprawl. We define ourselves that way, but there is, in all of those conversations, as you mentioned, there are people who are not included in terms of the people who are going into the trees every day, going and, you know, taking care of their cattle every day. They they simply want to be left alone. They don't want government to do something huge and innovative for them. They want to be left alone. They don't want anyone to come into their world. So, having been there, I was raised in rural Montana. That's exactly what my dad used to say all the time, just leave us alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So,
one of the things it sounds like will come out of your class and your discussions will be hopefully some tools that people can use to mm-hmm. build conversations against these microcultures mm-hmm. and help people to be of a more flexible mindset. Not that you throw away your identity, but you
right.
remain flexible and balanced to take advantage of positive opportunities to be sustainable and to keep your cultural identity flexible.
Correct. I hope.
Okay.
We're going to brainstorm a lot.
So,
I feel like I've overstayed my welcome here.
You know, because we hopefully try to interest people in the process that comes as a collateral benefit of PUG's classes. Like I said, you know, it's a different way of building your community mm-hmm. of conversation.
Yeah, and PUG's has a focus on not just creating knowledge, but creating community, so people go out afterwards and hang out and have additional conversations.
I can attest to that, and we had fun. Lots of spirited conversation.
Which course did you take?
It's funny because it really was psychologically and psychically draining for me, but it was the one about elegizing, poets elegizing Black lives lost to slavery, Jim Crow, et cetera, et cetera. And coming from a multiple heritage where all of my heritages were subject to that, it was a bit overwhelming for me, but it was a fabulous class in terms of creative insight and mm-hmm. Looking at the resilience and plasticity of the human spirit in the face of some really horrible things. And one of the things that I thought was really beneficial was a way to look at tragedy and not be immune to it, but not be overcome by it. You know, and how the creative mm-hmm. process allowed us to remember, but not necessarily be permanently overwhelmed by it, to see how there was a resiliency of spirit that, at least if nothing else, showed itself in being able to be objective about the situation.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, but I recommend them just because, again, it's a chance to have discussion and it's a chance to bring lived experience into a sharper focus within the academic world.
Right. Yeah.
I'd like to return a bit about your course and the type of people you might be interested in your course. Now, we mentioned as we began the Bundy brothers and all of that. Do you think that people who were either, how did you respond to that crisis and what did you learn from it and did that help shape how you developed this course?
That's a good question.
Well, first off, my reaction to it was, disgust in the sense, a couple of different reasons. One is that people of color are routinely killed for, reaching for their registration, for selling cigarettes on the street, for turning their back on a police officer, for any number of extraordinarily human actions. And yet, a group of armed white men and women could take over a public, federal facility, and have very little happen to them up until mm-hmm. the point of their arrest. So that was definitely a huge glaring issue that I saw. I also saw that the ranchers, the neighboring ranchers, the people who are living those lives that we just described, you know, and have built their culture around this, didn't want them there. It wasn't as though the Bundy brothers were being touted as the heroes, the people who were, you know, downtrodden by the latte-sipping bureaucrats. Those people, the ranchers, the people who were doing the really hard work, they didn't want them there. And so while they spoke to similar types of ideas, the Bundy brothers, in terms of the federal government should hand over land to the local people, they were saying things that have been spoken before in our country's history. I didn't find anything about what they were doing to be genuine, to be representative of the community that they were supposedly trying to represent. I saw it as an example of a huge exercise in white male privilege. That's the only way that they can see themselves getting anything done.
You know, what's fascinating about that, because of the southern migration of second and third southern sons, you know, to me it seemed like a reiteration and a kind of a movement, what do I want to say, a displaced states' rights issue. As if they were trying to force the hand, in much of the same way that the southern states did, to make it a states' rights issue, but they disguised it as a local control issue.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's not. I think that that's how it's been. These land use decisions are being touted that way. Mm-hmm. You know, the states should have the right to determine what goes on in their boundaries, that, you know, counties should run the local resources, that kind of thing. And while I can see the value, there was some of this, you know, some of the rhetoric is around the idea that if you know your local officials, they're going to represent you better. Like if, you know, we run into Ted Wheeler or Deborah Cafori in the grocery store, we're going to be able to talk to them and have an understanding about what we need. But at the same time, the states' rights issue, you know, who's going to decide what gets dumped into the Columbia River? Is it Washington? Is it Oregon? You know?
Is it the people who live right in the Columbia Gorge? Yeah.
Right. I mean, natural resources don't know state boundaries. They don't know county boundaries. We have to have an overall bigger picture way of managing them.
Well, we have a couple of callers in the last couple few minutes, so let's try to get to them. And let's go to our first caller,
Good
Ron.
Morning, Ron. You're on the air, Ron.
I'd just like to ask a couple of questions about contact information for the school and also for the guests this morning.
Well, let's see. We're both pulling up our information.
Oh, that's all you want.
Yeah.
I think it's pugspdx.org.
Yes.
.com.
Mm-hmm. And I am at Portland State University. My email is Teigen, T-E-I-G-E-N, K, at pdx.edu.
Okay.
And on the website, you can find out more information about other classes as well.
Okay. And is there a phone number or anything?
Let's see. I know
there
they
is
do
a phone
most
number
of the. Let me see here. Phooey.
I don't
see it either, so I'm afraid you'll have to access it probably.
It's on the website, I know.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you give that website a little slowly?
PUGSPDX.
T-U-G-S.
P as in Paul. U as in umbrella. G as in goat.
Okay.
As pdx.com, pugspdx.com.
P-U-G-P-D-X.com.
Right, pugs like a pug puppy, but with an S on it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
And we have another caller online.
Did we lose that person? Oh, there we go. Okay.
Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to mention, I heard a few minutes ago, I can't remember who said it, maybe it was your guest, that in the cities, there hasn't been so much community, perhaps. And it certainly seems to me there hasn't been, but I was reading a book from 1910, not too long ago. The author, Charles Edward Russell, was a reporter for a New York newspaper. And he pointed out that in Europe and in Japan and in the United States, there were at that time vigorous socialist movements setting up political programs and getting into office. And it just seems to me that with KABU we have a wonderful chance, which everybody seems to be taking, to say, let's think about a community-owned world where we all are sharing in something like the same way the Native Americans did. And I'll just leave it at that. Charles Edward Russell's book, though, is called Why I Am a Socialist. It was published in 1910. Anyway, just want to listen to your program now.
Oh, please come to the class.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, any last words? That's kind of way off topic. I don't recall us saying there was no community. I think we had a tighter context than that. But in response, Kristen?
Well, I do think that there are a wide variety of communities. I do think it's a challenge to get them all to the table, to get all communities represented in a way that is meaningful and real, and includes all of their voices in a substantial way. It might be easy to think that the communities aren't there because our institutions generally don't facilitate their involvement very well. But I do think that they are there. I agree.
Okay, and let's take our last caller and give you some time to promote your course.
Okay,
Mike.
Okay, just if the caller, the guest could talk about the Mormon, overlying Mormon influence on this and some of the rhetoric they used and expressions and statements you could see online. That just kind of demonstrates the insidiousness of this, that these people, when they talk about states' rights and we the people, they're literally talking about themselves. Anyway, thank you.
No, I agree. I think a lot of the movements around fighting for land rights, they're particularly when you look at the county supremacy movement and now Bundy brothers and the earlier rebellions, there is definitely a grounding in some Mormon ideologies. Mm-hmm. So he's absolutely right.
And last words on the course and how people might register.
They can register online at PUGS. At the PUGS website, it starts on August 8th on a Monday. It's every Monday, like I mentioned, in August. It's $125. The scholarships are available. It is at Hatch, which is a wonderful common space at 24th and Sandy, right by Booty Donut.
Oh yeah, so I know where Hatch people. Hatch is real close to the Latino Network, so it's
exactly.
A great community. It's bus accessible.
Yes, so I would be very happy to welcome more and more people to the course. I really appreciate this opportunity to chat about it.
Well, stay in touch, and because we'd love to have conversations with you anytime.
Okay, me too.
All right, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Kristen Tigan from the Portland Underground Graduate School, and she's teaching a class on the lands that we have in common and how they were acquired and how to sustainably share them. Speaking of sustainability, do sustain your community connection, KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 is the Old Mo Variety Hour with discussions on trade policies, Trump's decree by tweet, and other things. Locust Focus visits the Columbia Riverkeepers. At 11, it's Ground Radio, On the Ground Radio looking at Our Revolution, founded by Bernie Sanders. Thank you all KBOO members for your generous, generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one immediately by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Thank you so much. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Coonerin's Electric Fin Band, Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at the White Owl Social Club in Portland. Coonerin's Electric Fin Band and 1939 Ensemble perform Thai Psychedelia and are part of the Pickathon-sponsored White Owl Social Club's Outdoor Summer Concert Series. Again, that's the Coonerin's Electric Fin Band and 1939 Ensemble on Thursday, August 10th at 8 p.m. at White Owl Social Club, 1305 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
I wish I was a mole.